Hi, good morning. I'm Sancta St. Cyr, and this morning I'm going to present a case to you guys on ocular syphilis, and hopefully this case will just reinforce the need to look for additional cases in exposed populations. So my case is a 33-year-old white male with a history of eczema that actually presented with a chief complaint of vision loss for 3 weeks. He was admitted to the hospital after experiencing this decrease in his vision, which was also associated with photophobia and blurred vision. When he was describing how his symptoms were presenting itself, he complained of having a thumbprint over his right eye that obscured the upper and middle visual field, and he also complained of a thumbprint over his left eye that was obscuring the upper visual field. But 3 weeks prior to his hospitalization, he presented to an outside emergency department with visual changes. At that time, he had a CT scan done of his head. Sinusitis was visualized only. Therefore, he was discharged on Bactrim and was instructed to follow up with an ophthalmologist. Unfortunately, he didn't have any insurance and couldn't afford to see a doctor, so his vision loss continued to progress over the following weeks. Then, 2 days prior to his hospital admission, he complained of new periorbital and frontal headaches, also ocular pain. His photophobia continued to worsen, and his vision loss progressed to almost complete blindness. He was only able to tell shapes apart and be able to tell brightness from darkness. Due to his worsening symptoms, a friend of his gave him some money so he can finally see an ophthalmologist. So he was evaluated by an ophthalmologist, and that day that ophthalmologist was concerned that he had retinal necrosis. He was therefore sent directly to the UNC Chapel Hill Emergency Department for further evaluation. In the ED, he was evaluated emergently by ophthalmology. While he was being evaluated, they also noticed that he had some lesions on his trunk, palms, and soles. On review of systems, when he was asked about these lesions, he thought that they were all related to his known history of eczema. So in addition to eczema, he had a history of a spontaneous pneumothorax that was in the past. He also was a smoker. He had a use of marijuana history. He drank alcohol, was actually engaged to get married, was also a prior military man. A sexual history was not fully taken, but at that time, he admitted having sexual contact with 2 partners within the last year, but denied any male sexual partners in the past. So on physical examination, his skin lesions were further characterized as being hyperkeratotic, scaly plaques that were located on his torso, buttocks, palms, and soles. On his eye exam, his pupils were noted to be dilated, sluggish. He also had conjunctival injection, more prominent on the left than the right. His visual acuity was tested and was abnormal. They also demonstrated abnormal visual fields on the left, covering 3/4 of his vision, and on the right, half of it. He also had a genital urinary exam performed that didn't demonstrate any ulcerations, any lesions, masses, or any drainage seen. So these are some images of what was seen on his initial presentation. As you see, the conjunctival injection more prominent on the left, and then you see the hyperkeratotic lesions on his palms and his soles. So ophthalmology performed a slit lamp examination, and they felt that he had panuveitis. In addition to that, they also thought he had bilateral acute retinal necrosis. They felt that the extensive abnormalities in his retinal findings were suspicious for an infectious etiology. They therefore performed an anterior chamber paracentesis and collected aqueous humor so that PCR could be performed for viral pathogens. Additional testing demonstrated that he was HIV negative. His RPR was found to be 1 to 512. His TPPA was positive. He also had a lumbar puncture done that showed that he had a positive VDRL at 1 to 2, and he also had a pleocytosis that was lymphocytic predominant. Additional tests were also performed to look for causes of panuveitis and retinal necrosis, and as you see, multiple tests were found to be normal or negative. So based on his symptoms and his presentation, he was admitted to the hospital from the emergency department. He was diagnosed with having ocular syphilis, a form of neurosyphilis, and was provided with treatment for neurosyphilis, which is IV aqueous penicillin for a total of 14 days. He also got solumedrol for 3 days and steroid eye drops. It was felt that his signs were consistent with secondary syphilis infections. On further questioning during his hospitalization, he admitted to having a painless genital lesion earlier in the year. It was also felt that his hyperkeratotic plaques were collarette scales, which was pathognomonic for secondary syphilis. By the time he was discharged from the hospital a few days later, he didn't have any improvement in his visual symptoms. It was felt that his prognosis was poor, and on follow-up after completion of his antibiotics, he still had not had any improvement in his visual symptoms. So ocular syphilis can have many manifestations. It can present as anterior or posterior uveitis, panuveitis, episcleritis or scleritis, optic neuritis, retinal necrosis, or keratitis. Ocular syphilis can occur at any stage during syphilis infection, but is most commonly seen during secondary syphilis. As mentioned, ocular syphilis is treated the same way as neurosyphilis, and in some case reports, visual loss can be reversible if it's treated early, but in this case, it appears that it was not. So, as mentioned earlier, there's been an increase in ocular syphilis cases that has been noted. Generally, case reports have reported that there's an incidence of less than 1% of ocular syphilis per new syphilis cases per year. It is uncommonly seen in HIV negative patients, but is more commonly seen in men who have sex in men and in HIV positive patients. Actually, in some cases, they have reported that ocular syphilis was the triggering event to get tested for HIV and diagnosed in patients with new HIV. Many states across the U.S. have reported increased numbers in ocular syphilis, including California and Washington. In North Carolina, there was actually a 40% increase of ocular syphilis cases from 2014 to 2015. So hopefully this case just demonstrated that although ocular syphilis is seen more commonly in men who have sex with men and in patients who are HIV positive, you can still have positive cases occurring in heterosexual patients who are HIV negative. And so there's therefore a need to look for ocular syphilis in patients who have ocular symptoms if they are having any sexual contact at all. Thank you.
Thanks for that excellent presentation. I'd like to invite our esteemed discussants up here to bring up some of these pertinent points that you presented so eloquently. I'd like to introduce Khalil Ghanem from Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, Susan Tuddenham from Johns Hopkins, the STD HIV Prevention Training Center, and Ina Park from the California Department of Public Health. Please join us for an interesting discussion. So one of the first questions I have for you, Sankta, was I think I missed it on your slide. I didn't hear it in terms of the testing for other STIs as well as HIV.
Yes. So there was additional testing performed. We actually did, in addition to HIV and syphilis testing, we also did chlamydia and gonorrhea testing as well. And he was swabbed both from his oropharyngeal cavity and also had the NAT test done from his urine.
I wanted Susan to comment about this in terms of the ocular presentation. I know you wrote a nice editorial recently in STI regarding ocular syphilis, and I wanted you to put this case in parallel to the case that you and Khalil reviewed from the Japanese, the case series from ocular syphilis, and make some comments in parallels.
Sure, I think that would be great. So great case and very interesting, and I think your last point was very important, that although with the first cluster of cases reported out of Seattle and San Francisco, this is predominantly in HIV-positive MSM, and many of the subsequent cases have been as well, that we really have to remember to look for ocular syphilis in other populations too. I think with regards to that Japanese case series, that was in HIV-positive patients. But one point I think to make is that bringing these patients into care early is very important because they found in that case series that if patients waited and were not evaluated and treated into basically greater than 28 days, they had much worse outcomes and the prognosis was much worse. So I think that's an important point to take home both from your case and from that case series. And also just wanted to comment, we had published a small case series that I contributed relatively minimally to, I think, Dr. Wright Major and Dr. Gatos and my co-fellow, the PTC, Grace Marks, took the lead on compiling that. But similarly, those were just a few selected cases. We had six cases, but three out of those six were actually HIV negative, and one of them was a heterosexual woman. So also emphasizing, together with your great case here, that we really have to be alert for this syndrome in a variety of patients.
So one of the other things I want to bring up is the use of ocular steroids, because I know the data is somewhat conflicting, and I wanted Khalil to comment about that as well. And I know that I think it was used in this case.
So the data are conflicting, and in fact, there are very limited data. I mean, if you look at the case series that get published, the biggest problem we have with ocular syphilis, I think, is that the largest case series have fewer than 50 patients in general. And so when you're trying to figure out exactly what you should be doing with these patients, it becomes very complicated to see what's data-driven and what's purely sort of, historical and best guess. And I think with steroids, particularly systemic steroids, the data are very limited. If you ask ophthalmologists why do you use steroids, they say we would use steroids in the setting of inflammation. Now remember, not all syphilitic conditions of the eye are inflammatory. And they say that if you are actually dealing with an inflammatory condition, it makes sense to use steroids because it tends to limit, or it may help limit the damage that's caused due to that inflammation. And so they tend to be very excited about topical steroids. And I have to say, with the limited experience we've had with ocular cases at Hopkins, when you add, particularly with uveitis, when you add a topical steroid, it makes a huge difference fast. And so that, again, is not data-driven. It's purely sort of observation with a small or limited number of cases. Systemic steroids are a bit more complex, and I think the data don't go, I mean, in reading the literature, I think it's very hard to know whether you should be using them or not. And so I leave it open to individual ophthalmologists in deciding what they want to do. But topical steroids with inflammatory lesions seem to provide perhaps some benefit. Again, not data-driven.
So one of the other aspects of this case that I find interesting is the misdiagnosis. That is one thing in particular that I've been very impressed with in terms of the house staff. That they really, unless they forget how to examine a patient, number one, and they don't put syphilis on their differential, especially if somebody's got eczema and they start thinking down that line. So that's one point, Ina. The other thing to talk about is the LP. And whether or not the LP is positive or not. We recently had a case of a patient that came in with severe headache to Emory, and we were consulted because he was HIV positive out of care. And nobody had asked him whether he had any eye findings at all. They thought he was narcotic seeking. And they actually LP'd him, and his LP was normal. And so they said, yes, we know he's got an RPR of 1 to 256. We know we need to give him a shot of benzathine. But nobody put the headache together and so I think this is something that we're missing. So I wanted you to comment on the misdiagnosis and also the indication for LP.
Okay. Sure. And I also, since I'm on the other coast from Khalil and Sue, I just wanted to add really quickly that our in the handful of cases we've consulted on, the ophthalmologists and generally favored using ocular steroids as well. But I primarily work and teach residents who are in primary care, and some of whom are in primary care but going into an HIV track. So I remember giving a talk to them, a didactic lecture about syphilis and mentioning ocular syphilis and the fact that we've observed clusters in California, and none of them had even heard of ocular syphilis or had any awareness that syphilis could affect the eye or that it could affect other organ systems. And so I think part of that was just educating, you know, our family practice and internal medicine residents that syphilis can have multiple manifestations, and just to even put it on people's radar. Because when people are seeing a rash and you're in primary care, the first thing you're thinking about is a common presentation of something like eczema, especially when they have a prior history. You're not immediately jumping to ocular syphilis. So on the health department end, you know, we've made a push to try to educate providers first, and then of course down to the providers in training, about syphilis and the fact that it is increasing and the fact that it can manifest. So it has to be on your mind, or you aren't necessarily going to think about it and order the right testing. The LP is another issue, because in California we've consulted on a handful of cases, and especially in our rural communities, it's very difficult for folks that are uninsured to get transport, for example, to emergency departments. And so when someone is coming into HIV care and yet they don't have a county hospital, for example, they don't have a good safety net provider to go to get an LP, what the provider is asking me is, they're saying, if I'm going to treat with penicillin anyway, IV, for what I presume is ocular syphilis, because this person has a positive RPR and they have ocular findings, why do I need to do an LP? You know, it's going to be a huge hassle. It's going to cost the patient a lot of money. They have enough income that they're going to be getting a bill. And so, you know, they're asking me, why can't I just treat the patient with IV penicillin? And in some cases where it really has seemed difficult, I say the important thing is to get antibiotic therapy. And, you know, ideally we would have an LP to be able to follow, for example, if they have a positive VDRL or pleocytosis, be able to follow their progress over time and document that they're improving. But it is a huge challenge, I wanted to point out, and not all providers are that enthusiastic about getting that when it provides you know, logistical and financial challenges for the patient.
So the other thing that's come up recently is we've been contacted recently about, as you know, shortages of penicillin. And those of you that have experienced that recently, the question is what to do in a situation where your patient is uninsured and you have no access to penicillin, or what would you choose? And so I want to bring that kind of scenario up, because we're getting increasing calls about that. As you know, being as an infectious disease doctor, every week there's a new antibiotic, there's a shortage. And so you have to be creative, and I think the biggest thing for me is linking them up with somebody in the health department, the state public health department, to know where they can find. But private providers or providers don't know who to call. And so I want to bring that up for discussion as well, in terms of alternative therapies. And the issue is, how have you dealt with this and what would you suggest? Khalil?
Oh. All right. So just a couple of points of clarification. I mean, when you diagnose ocular syphilis, the CDC recommends that no matter what lesion you diagnose related to ocular syphilis, whether it's early ocular syphilis or tertiary ocular syphilis, the recommendation is to treat as if it were neurosyphilis, even though the two entities are different. To me, I mean, so far we've not luckily had IV penicillin shortage. And so I think by definition you automatically go with IV penicillin, which is the drug where we have most of the data. I usually go for IV penicillin immediately. If for any reason we were to have a shortage of IV penicillin, I think I would probably, there are some data, some case limited case reports of the use of doxycycline for the treatment of ocular syphilis, and I think that would certainly be much lower on my choice. But I think you're limited. I mean, I don't think ceftriaxone is another agent where we have limited data, and I think I would probably do either IV penicillin. If IV penicillin were not available, I would automatically go to ceftriaxone, which probably penetrates the areas adequately. And if that's not the case, and if we don't have ceftriaxone, I mean, I'm going sort of down really low on what I would probably lose some sleep over using doxycycline, but there are some case reports of the use of doxycycline in those settings. So, but certainly IV penicillin would be the first choice. I just want to mention one thing about the LP issue. Mm-hmm. You don't need an LP to make a diagnosis of ocular syphilis, but I really do think that the LP can be very helpful. I mean, this was a classic case of ocular syphilis. It does not get more classic than that with the rash, secondary syphilis, et cetera. Most of the cases that we see, it's some visual loss, something. And, you know, the RPR is very low titer or even negative with a positive, you know, treponemal test. And then on the differential diagnosis, ocular syphilis is there, but 100 other things are there. And so often the LP can, if it's positive, remembering full well that in 30% of cases of ocular syphilis, the LP will be negative. But if it's positive, it can give you some credence to making the diagnosis of ocular syphilis. So just for that.
Yeah, the last thing I just want to end on, and then we'll move to the next case, is the reason I bring this up is because there have been instances around the country of penicillin shortages, and people have contacted us about what to do. The other thing that you may be aware of is this is kind of more important internationally, and we've been contacted by folks in South America who are having incredible problems with penicillin availability. Mm-hmm. And thinking about this coming up and taking another step to congenital syphilis, and thinking about what agents are available for congenital syphilis and talking to our pediatric colleagues about what to use. And one of the things that came up was ampicillin. And there's not much data at all on ampicillin. And the question is, do you feel comfortable with that? So these are some of the discussions we're having, because we're having these rolling shortages. And it is not, if it's not a problem in your area, it will be. And then internationally, we're dealing with this a lot in terms of these shortages of medication. So now I'm going to turn it over to John Zentelman, who is going to have Teresa come up and from Teresa Battinger from Indiana University and present the second case. Thank you so much.